Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Prostate Cancer. And this is a two-part series, so this is part two, and it's dealing with the side effects of prostate cancer treatments. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have over 527 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, Kenya, the Netherlands, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and we're delighted to have you with us today. Now, today's program, this entire, actually, series, was supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Services, LLC, and was supported by an educational donation provided by Amgen as well. So we really want to thank them for supporting this entire series. Now, we have you have received from us some materials in preparation for the program, and in those materials you have an outline that our speakers will be addressing and the speakers' information about them. You also have information about all of the different collaborating organizations, and you also have an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. Your feedback is really very important to us. You really tell us what we should be offering and what you would find most helpful in these workshops. So we very much depend upon your feedback. Indeed, this whole series and today's topic is one that has been recommended by many of you, and therefore we're offering it. So tell us what you'd like us to offer, and we will do our very best to offer those programs. Now, we have wonderful speakers, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. And Dr. Slovin is Associate Attending Physician, Genitourinary Oncology Service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She's also Associate Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. And Dr. Slovin is going to provide an overview of prostate cancer and its treatments, and discuss common side effects of prostate cancer treatments, including pain and neuropathy, and discuss nutritional and physical activity concerns, as well as the role of clinical trials. It's my pleasure to now turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Susan Slovin.
Thank you, Carolyn, and once again, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Many of you may recall about 2 weeks ago I was on the forum, again, addressing some of your concerns. There's just never enough time to deal with everything that I could possibly talk about in prostate cancer, and I hope that if I am not addressing anything that you are concerned about, then please do feel free during the question and answer session to discuss it with us. If we talk about prostate cancer, we would have a really multidimensional conference. I mean, there's just so many new and exciting things going on. But I, again, would like to focus in on patients whose cancers have come back despite definitive treatments such as radiation or surgery. And the reason is that many of the new drugs that are out there, and many of them are what we call targeted drugs, are available, and they are really changing the course of the disease and actually improving quality of life and really making life a lot better for patients. The standard treatment for localized prostate cancer, as many of you know, remains surgery or radiation, or it may in fact also include just active surveillance. And active surveillance really mandates that you are followed very, very closely by your urologist, sometimes with receiving additional prostate biopsies at least every 6 months, maybe even an MRI, and ascertainment of the rate of rise of your PSA. Remember that expectant monitoring or active surveillance is really an active treatment in the sense that you're being followed very closely, and that if the cancer does change or the biopsy shows new or worsening disease, of course, a change in treatment is needed. But people don't seem to understand that compliance on their part, along with cooperation as it relates to follow-up with their physician, is extremely, extremely important in how your outcome will ultimately present itself. For patients who have disease that has progressed beyond the confines of the prostate, either a diagnosis, meaning it has gone to lymph nodes or bone, or this cancer has come back after primary treatment such as surgery or radiation, the standard treatment option is hormonal therapy. And that makes use of an injection that goes by a variety of different names, Trelstar, Lupron, Zoladex. All of them work by inhibiting the signal or interfering with the signal from the brain to the testes such that the testes are no longer in communication with the brain and they're really not sure whether they should continue or not continue producing testosterone. Over a course of time, the testes don't get that signal and they just shut off, and the side effects that can often happen is really that a man will go through a chemical-induced menopause. Now, that's not to say that every man who undergoes what we call biochemical or chemical castration is truly going to experience menopausal symptoms such as the ones that women often experience. When I often start somebody on hormonal therapy, I will present to them a list of side effects only to find out that they may develop one side effect, whereas another may experience nothing, or another person may experience every possible one. Now, it's very important that we keep close eyes and that you participate with your primary care physician because some of the side effects may impact on your overall well-being. This includes, but is not limited to, accelerated osteoporosis, a very mild asymptomatic anemia, sometimes some mood swings. Some people become very short-tempered. Others become very emotionally labile or tearful. There may be some mild breast development, a term called gynecomastia. And some men immediately say, oh, I'm going to get female bosoms. Well, you're not. What it is that men and women alike have estrogen and testosterone. Women have more estrogen than testosterone, and men are the converse, more testosterone than estrogen. When you suppress the production of testosterone, estrogen is now unopposed, meaning there's no testosterone to suppress its production. And as a result, you get stimulation of the breasts, and some men do, in fact, have more breast tissue. It's not to the point that some men need to undergo reduction mammoplasties, but for many, it's been tolerable, and the only time that I think most people complain is if some men who have very prominent pectoral, sort of the Arnold Schwarzenegger type of chest, the bosoms may look a little bit more prominent. And in some cases, breast radiation has been done to try to kill some of the proliferative or actively growing benign breast tissue. If the cancer does well, meaning responds to therapy, patients can either remain on hormones or go on hormonal therapy intermittently. And again, this is something that is based on some data, but also the preference of your physician. One should never go on and off treatment without a physician actually mandating how that should occur. But where we have the biggest challenge right now are those patients who have failed hormonal therapy, who may or may not have metastatic disease that you can see on scans, but who ultimately are completely without symptoms. There's no pain, no fatigue, they're active, and we then face the treatment options. Many patients are afraid of the big C. The big C is not cancer, it's chemotherapy. And as I've mentioned in prior conferences on cancer care, my own preference for starting chemotherapy is really threefold. One is for a patient whose PSAs are doubling or tripling so quickly that I really don't have a handle on it, and no matter what I do, they're just rapidly rising. Or someone is just not thriving, they don't have energy, they're not eating, they just don't feel well. And the third is someone who has so much disease that I would have to radiate multiple parts of their bony structures and ultimately impact on their ability to make their red blood cells, that it would not be in their best interest to receive radiation unless there's really pain at those sites. And so chemotherapy not only can improve quality of life, but it actually can put the disease under much better control. Patients are still able to go to work, do things. The chemotherapy that remains the standard of care is docetaxel or Taxotere. And really the main side effects have been some thinning of the hair. I really don't remember the last time I saw anybody with nausea, vomiting. There is the potential to drop the white blood cell count, which is called neutropenia, but it's really very few and far between. And as I said, it's very, very user-friendly. Now, getting back to that person who has failed hormonal therapy and has no evidence of disease, there are standard treatments. We were very fortunate within the last year to see the first immunotherapy product called Provenge. The other name for it is Cipolucel-T. This is a cellular product immunotherapy whereby your peripheral blood cells are removed through an apparatus called leukapheresis, where all they do is take out your white blood cells and leave your red blood cells intact. You still have billions of them, so it's not of any concern. And these blood products are removed, taken to a central laboratory. They are incubated with a certain protein to stimulate the growth of these cells, and then 48 hours later, these cells are returned to the body. And this has been shown to be effective and provide certain benefits. This is covered by Medicare. I believe there's 80% coverage. It's been found to be safe and has, again, some significant benefits for the patient. Now, there have been two new drugs that have been FDA approved recently. They are oral drugs. They are not chemotherapy. And they have initially been approved really for patients who have failed chemotherapy. But they are being brought to the earlier part of cancer care, meaning that somebody who has failed hormones and has no evidence of disease but has rising PSA is exactly the same population who would receive Provenge, but they can be used earlier before chemo for patients who do have metastatic disease and have failed hormones. So both populations are very reasonable. The first is Zytiga. The other name for it is abiraterone. All you got to know is Zytiga. And this is an oral drug that works at the level of two tiny little organs on top of each kidney called the adrenal glands. And this has been shown to really have significant improvement in patients' quality of life, not to mention improvement in metastatic disease and even improvement in pain. So there will be an indication for this drug to be moved to the earlier setting as opposed to where it currently is after chemotherapy. The most recent drug that's FDA approved is called Xtandi, X-T-A-N-D-I. The other name for it is enzalutamide, and many of you may have heard the name MDV-3100. This, too, is an oral drug. It is a hormone-like drug, just as Zytiga is. However, it bears a lot of similarity to an anti-androgen pill that is given with Lupron or Zoladex called Casodex, except this is a much higher potency drug and has excellent safety profile, minimal side effects, but is also being moved from the post-chemotherapy area into pre-chemotherapy. So there's a lot of drugs that are out there now. In fact, probably as time goes on, many of our urologic colleagues will be starting patients on these drugs and people will be seeing, we hope not, but maybe seeing the oncologist a lot later. In addition to chemotherapy, we've been very fortunate to have an FDA-approved second-line chemotherapy called Gemtana, and this drug has also had significant impact on providing good treatment salvage, meaning rescuing people who have failed treatment with docetaxel. They actually have responded very well. So it's for docetaxel failures, but have done well. Main side effect for that drug has really been a diminution or a reduction in the white blood cell count. But again, that too is very, very manageable, and we do have drugs that will counteract these low white blood cell counts by an injection that stimulates your bone marrow to make more cells. All of these treatments are very well and good, but that doesn't mean that while you have no side effects from these drugs or minimal side effects, that your cancer doesn't every now and then cause pain and other issues. And part of the problem is that sometimes many of our patients are older or have been sports buffs for many, many years. And what ends up happening is that one never knows whether it's degenerative arthritis that is causing the problem versus cancer. We've had patients who have osteoporosis at the get-go, and they very often may have what we call a compression fracture, which is just the loss of height of a vertebrae as a result of just wear and tear or arthritis or even cancer. And when I often encourage patients that if they do have pain, pain meaning that it is unremitting, it just does not respond to any treatment, that it is much better to have a scan performed and have a sense of what's going on rather than ignoring it and just keep popping aspirin or Tylenol. The other thing is that patients who have been on certain chemo drugs, such as docetaxel or even Gemtana, may experience numbness or tingling in their fingers and toes. But please keep in mind that people who have diabetes, long-standing diabetes, may have similar problems, what we call neuropathy. And sometimes you're just never sure whether it's the chemo, is it the diabetes that is worsening the overall side effects as a result of the chemo. The point is that there are many drugs that are out there to deal with neuropathic pain. Very often I have sent patients to physiatrists or rehabilitation doctors who can perform what we call EMGs, which is a monitoring of the ability of the nerves to respond to electrical activity, just to see whether or not there is a problem with the nerve's ability to move the muscle, or is it there's something about the nerve itself. And this has been working very well, and the physiatrists are able to give medications as well. But on the most part, we know that some people respond to high doses of glutamine. Again, nothing I would rush to buy over the counter, but one should definitely discuss this with one's oncologist or physiatrist. Anticonvulsants have been shown, such as Neurontin, for example, or even Lyrica, have very, very mildly sedating effects that will not affect anybody's ability to think, or will not make them very sleepy, but can actually, with gradual escalation of the dose, really improve the neuropathy. Physical therapy can be used. It's what they call the TENS unit, which is electrical stimulation. Even antidepressants such as Cymbalta has been used with excellent pain results. And an improvement in the neuropathy. For pain, we always start off with a little bit of Tylenol, sometimes Advil, sometimes Aleve. But again, one should not take this in the setting of very poor kidney function. It's always that you should call your doctor, make the doctor aware of what your pain is, describe it. Some pains are dull, sometimes they're radiating. And it's extremely important that you yourself talk to the doctor. This is my pet peeve, because sometimes a wife or daughter or son or somebody, in an effort to be very helpful to the patient, will give their own translation or assessment of the patient's pain, and as such, you're getting their assessment. But when you talk to the patient and ask very specific pointed questions, you might find that the pain is very different in quality, intensity, and everything else. So I would often urge patients to please get on the phone and speak to the nurse yourself, or even the doctor if that person's available, and see if you can give a better education to the doctor as to the nature of the pain. There are many clinical trials, by the way, that are out there. I always prefer clinical trials because it gives the patient the opportunity to try to impact and change the biology of the cancer earlier on. There are some wonderful clinical trials. There's a drug that's being looked at by the FDA called XL184, cabozantinib. It is an antibody, which is a drug that has exquisite sensitivity to certain pathways that control the growth of the cancer cells. And what's very nice about it is that it's been associated with marked improvement in pain. This drug ultimately has a very high likelihood of coming to FDA approval, but still is in clinical trials. Another drug, radium-223, has been used for pain palliation. This is what we call an alpha emitter, and in Europe has already been used extensively in people who have rheumatologic disorders and is associated with pain control. So we have a lot of things that are out there. Now, what I do want to clarify is that clinical trials are very often misrepresented. What they are studies that are being done that introduce either new drugs or old drugs into a specific patient population. The old drugs may be given on a different schedule in combination, for example, with biologic agents, or they may be new drugs that has already been shown to have some modest activity, but when given on a different schedule or in combination with other drugs, may end up being much more robust in controlling the cancer. So I actually feel that it is to everybody's benefit to be on a clinical trial. And the benefit of the clinical trial as well is if your doctor doesn't feel that you're benefiting, you come off and you go on to something else. And no one should ever feel locked into being in a clinical trial. And lastly, the role of nutrition. People ask me, should I go to a nutritionist? Should I do this? I think that everybody should have a straightforward healthy diet, fruits, vegetables, grains. Many of my patients go to the extremes of taking supra-therapeutic doses of vitamins, which can be very toxic to the liver or interact with the absorption of other standard either antihypertensive drugs or even chemotherapy or other drugs that can be used for control of the disease. I think it's extremely important for people to eat well. I have nothing wrong against people taking a daily multivitamin, but the most the best probable thing you can do for yourself is maintain a good exercise schedule. I always tell people to stick with a routine because it's so easy, particularly if you're occasionally taking a narcotic, to feel a little bit more lethargic and tired. And please remember, the longer you remain sedentary, the greater the likelihood you can get a blood clot and the greater the likelihood you're becoming even more deconditioned. So I would urge everybody to try to set a schedule that every day for a certain period of time you're up, you're walking. It also contributes to bone health. The more you do, the better the bone, the less likely you are to have any sort of trauma to your bone that would immediately lead to being incapacitated. There are bone strengthening agents that I'm sure many of you know about, zoledronic acid or Zometa. Another one is called Xgeva. They are available and part of normal cancer care and bone health. So I know I've been very rapid. Happy to address any of these during the question time, and I will go right back to you, Carolyn. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Slovin, for just a superb presentation overview of really many of the issues that many of the callers are experiencing with prostate cancer and its treatments. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Francois Eade, and Dr. Eade is Clinical Associate Professor of Urology, Weill Cornell Medical College of Cornell University, and he's Director of Advanced Urological Care, PC. We're delighted to have him with us today, and Dr. Eade is going to address managing incontinence and sexual dysfunction, communicating with your healthcare team about your specific needs, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Eade.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here as well. I'd like to begin my discussion of the types of incontinence that are encountered in men, and I think it's useful to define these before we go on to treating incontinence after prostate cancer treatment. So we know that there is the type of incontinence that is called urge incontinence, and that's leakage associated with an overwhelming need to urinate, and it's also known as overactive bladder. There's the stress incontinence, which is leakage during physical activity that increases intra-abdominal pressure, like lifting, exercising, sneezing, or coughing. And then there is the mixed incontinence. Now, why is this important? Well, it's important because men before the prostate is removed may have a little bit of both. They may have a little bit of an overactive bladder, and at the same time, once the prostate is removed, they'll have stress incontinence. And this is important because it gives us an opportunity to treat these patients with medications that treat the overactive component of the incontinence. So it's important for you to communicate with your healthcare professional as to the status of your incontinence after the prostate cancer procedure. Now, I'd like to step back for a second and look at what is the most common type of incontinence after radiation versus after prostate cancer removal? After radiation, there is perhaps some irritation or damage to the bladder, and a lot of patients will get an overactive type of bladder incontinence, and after the prostate is removed, it is mostly stress incontinence. Now, the incontinence that occurs after radiation may not occur right away. It may take a while to show up. The effects of radiation may show up as late as a year and a half after the treatment. So if urge incontinence occurs late after treatment, again, one needs to consult their healthcare professional, and there are medications that can calm the bladder down, such as Vesicare or Detrol, and alleviate the symptoms. The difference between prostate cancer removal is that the incontinence occurs right away, immediately after the prostate cancer is removed. This incontinence most often is temporary and will improve by itself over a period of 12 to 18 months. Now, it's important to do something while this is occurring, such as rehabilitation of the pelvic floor and Kegel exercises, and usually the surgeons who remove the prostate will have a team in place to help with that. But again, I urge you to take an active role in biofeedback and pelvic floor rehabilitation, which can make a big difference in the long run. There are medications that can also help with the stress type incontinence, and Dr. Slovin mentioned Cymbalta for pain. We often will use that to enhance the function of the sphincter that has been perhaps slightly damaged or stretched during the removal of the prostate, and that in some patients can be helpful. Other treatments for the incontinence include clamps. Of course, some men will need small diapers or a pad, and then there are procedures such as slings and sphincters. Now, the slings are in vogue currently, and there are several manufacturers that make these slings, and a sling essentially is a mesh that is placed at the level of the perineum, which is the area between the rectum and the base of the scrotum, and it applies pressure and support to the bladder. Slings are a little bit tricky. They're mostly for patients with very mild incontinence, and one needs to seek an experienced physician for these slings. It's a newer treatment option, so not many have a lot of experience with these devices, but they can be helpful in cases of very mild incontinence. We also see the type of incontinence that occurs during orgasm, during sexual activity. Men after prostate cancer treatment can experience these, and these can be difficult to treat at times, and it can be alleviated by different positions during sexual activity, and also in some patients that where it's permissible, we will give the patient a large dose of Sudafed, again, to improve the function of the sphincter and perhaps diminish the leakage of urine during orgasm. With the, it's important for patients not to become bladder dependent. In other words, what we see sometimes is a patient who has incontinence after prostate cancer surgery and will plan his whole day around the fact that there is incontinence. So he will know where every bathroom is located. He will make sure that he doesn't lift or strain, that he remains sedentary so that he diminishes the amount of diapers that he uses. And so when the patient will present to the healthcare professional, the patient may be asked how many diapers or how many pads you use a day, and the patient will say, I use, well, one pad a day, but this one pad a day is with an altered lifestyle. So it's important to maintain your normal lifestyle and to communicate with your healthcare professional exactly what is going on. If you drink normally, if you are active, if you play golf, so that your doctor can better manage your incontinence. When that is done, most often we find that patients who complain of incontinence usually are best treated with an artificial urinary sphincter. There's only one company that makes this artificial urinary sphincter. It's called American Medical System. It is a very, very successful device. It's been on the market since 1980, and it is really the gold standard for the treatment of moderate to severe incontinence. Physicians who do this procedure are quite good at it, and they can do it in 60 minutes or less, and patients usually will go home either the same day or spend one night in the hospital. The artificial urinary sphincter can also be enhanced by adding a second sphincter cuff, and many patients are completely dry with the second sphincter cuff. Now, we often have situations where patients have both erectile dysfunction and incontinence, and then a patient may be interested in an artificial urinary sphincter but also wants to have his erectile dysfunction treated. So you have to decide whether you should do both the penile implant and artificial urinary sphincter device at the same time, and this is something that I do not recommend, but I don't know that there are some of my colleagues that will offer that to patients, but I think that it's best to just do one device at a time. In case there is a problem, such as an infection, you do not have to remove both devices. You may ask the question whether you should do the penile implant first or the artificial urinary sphincter first, and it is always best to do the penile implant first because it makes for an easier dissection of the urethra to place the artificial urinary sphincter cuff once the penile implant is in place. The number two reason for doing it in that sequence is that the sphincter is a more delicate device and it needs to be deactivated when the patient will undergo the penile implant. So you don't want to become incontinent again temporarily after you've had your sphincter. So it's best to do the penile implant first. You let it heal for about 2 to 3 months, and then you come back and get the artificial urinary sphincter. Other treatment that I didn't mention include, obviously, a catheter, but that is something that is perhaps temporarily useful, and it can be attached to a leg bag. There is an increased risk of infection, of course, and we want to stay away from that as well. And then there is something we call the Cunningham clamp, which is a clamp that you can place around the penis. And again, these are devices that can be used temporarily while the a patient is contemplating a procedure or another treatment options. With this, I'd like to move to the treatment of erectile dysfunction. And first, I want to just discuss a few concepts, and that is to distinguish for all of us the difference between nerves that are in charge of producing an erection and nerves that are for sensation, or which are what we call the cutaneous nerves, which are the nerves that are what involved in orgasm and ejaculation. And it's important for patients to understand that when the doctors remove the prostate, what gets stretched or damaged or injured are the erectile nerves, that the patient is still able to have an orgasm even with a soft penis. So the patient should not refrain from sexual activity if the nerves were, for example, removed because the prostate cancer had grown out of the prostate. It's also important to understand that ejaculation is lost after prostate cancer surgery. However, orgasm is present. It may feel a little bit different. And some patients after radiation, for example, may have decreased ejaculation and also pain on ejaculation, and it's important to know that that is temporary and will always go away. We've had patients with pain on orgasm after prostate cancer surgery for an extensive period of time, maybe almost a year to a year and a half, and we try to give medications such as anti-inflammatory, Motrim, about an hour before sexual activity, and also we use Cymbalta for those patients successfully. Now, there are some changes that occur to the penis after prostate cancer treatment, and that specifically that occurs after radical prostatectomy. We see a shrinkage of the penis that can occur if the nerves are injured. We call that atrophy. There's also formation of scar tissue, lumps or bumps in the shaft of the penis, and some patients will have a hourglass deformity of the penile shaft, or curvature of the penis. Now, all of these alterations of the anatomy will not be noticeable by the patient if there is no sexual activity. So it's a reason to engage in sexual activity so that you can monitor to see what's happening. Now, why is that important? Because if something is changing, again, you want to consult with your doctor so that the doctor can be proactive than waiting for the penis to shrink and get to a small size and be dissatisfied with the result. There's also the idea of penile rehabilitation that is often offered to patients, and it involves taking a pill such as Viagra or Cialis on a daily basis after the surgery. There is a lot of discussion in our field whether this makes any difference or not. There's a few publications that have ascertained that there is such a thing as rehabilitation. However, the data is still not out, and I think while we're waiting to see whether this is really successful or not, I recommend that to all patients, even patients who absolutely have no response whatsoever with medications such as Viagra. These medications are very safe, and the only disadvantage will be the cost. However, some insurance now are beginning to cover this for the purpose of rehabilitation, and I think that it's worthwhile doing. I'd like to discuss now some of the treatment options for erectile dysfunction and outline some of the pros and cons of each treatment option. Now, I'm sure all of you are familiar with the class of drug called phosphodiesterase inhibitor, and that includes Viagra, Levitra, and Cialis. I was fortunate to be participant in the clinical trials of these medications, and very early on we noticed that about 30% of patients after prostate cancer treatment who also had erectile dysfunction were responding to Viagra or Levitra or Cialis. So if you are one of those 30%, then it's a good idea to take these medications on a daily basis, especially Cialis. I'm very fond of Cialis because of its long half-life. Cialis will stay in the system for 36 hours, which means that if you take a small dose of 5 milligram every day, after about 5 days, you reach therapeutic levels, and then it stays in your system. The drug also improves blood flow to the base of the bladder, and the drug is also FDA approved for the treatment of benign prostate hypertrophy and urinary symptoms. So, so far we've been very fortunate to have this medication. Viagra is also a wonderful drug, and Levitra is good as well. They're all in the same class. And what these medications do, they block the enzyme that takes away erection. So you have to have some nerve activity. You have to have some release of the chemical nitric oxide in order for these medications to work. They do not provide an erection if there is an ability to have a partial erection by the patient. So for the 70% of patients after prostate surgery, for example, we find that we need to have another treatment options. Patients after radiation therapy usually respond better to these pills. Patients after radiation therapy may develop erectile dysfunction a year to a year and a half after the treatment. Typically, patients who develop erectile dysfunction after radiation therapy have blocked arteries to the penis, whereas patients who have erectile dysfunction after prostate cancer surgery, actually their dysfunction is due to a nerve injury. Regardless, penile injection therapy is a good treatment option. It is very effective. It works in about 90% of patients. It is quite painless. The term injection is awful, and I have never found a patient who enjoyed injecting his penis or was looking forward to injecting his penis. However, if you intellectualize the treatment option, you realize that it is probably the least invasive of all our treatment options. Since you're putting the medication right where it's supposed to act, you can put a very small dose, such as 5 microgram of prostaglandin E1 or alprostadil, which is the only FDA-approved medication for penile injection, and this medication is very effective and produces an erection. The problem with penile injections is not the pain, it's not the needle, it's doing it. It's very distasteful to a lot of men, and it's an interruption to what should be a very romantic and natural human activity. So to render this activity in a medical fashion is not appealing to a lot of couples. But it is a good option, and I think that while a patient may wait to see whether nerves grow back for a year to 2 years after the prostate cancer surgery, it's a good temporary treatment option. We have an ability to deliver the same medication with a urethral suppository. It's developed by a company called Vivus. It's called Muse. And unfortunately, this treatment option is very painful because the amount of the medication is huge, and most of it does not penetrate the erectile tissue of the penis. It goes into the urethra and the head or the glans penis and causes a dull ache or a burn in the penis. So it is effective for some, but the majority of patients will not respond well to this treatment options. Vacuum devices can also be used. This is very similar to a breast pump, and patients can apply this to the penis, create a negative pressure around the penis, which draws blood into the penis, and then a rubber band is snapped at the base of the penis. Patients who have a little bit of incontinence will have a problem with this treatment option, as it will also draw urine into the vacuum chamber. And again, during lovemaking, this is not a very romantic thing to occur, but it is something to consider for as a temporary option. And then finally, we have penile implants. Now, penile implants have been around since 1973, especially the inflatable devices. There are only two companies that make these devices in the world, American Medical System and Coloplast. The devices are incredible. They will last 20 years in some patients. excellent candidates for a penile implant are patients who obviously don't respond to oral therapy, and patients who've tried oral therapy or have severe side effects. Nowadays, some patients are even choosing this option because of issues of finances, of cost. And it is the only option that restores spontaneous, normal sexual intimacy and what you could call a cure of the erectile dysfunction. Now, why is this the best option for many? Well, because a patient who has a penile implant has a complete control of the duration of firmness of the erection. And one can avoid the side effects of ongoing medication. Now, what the implant is a minor procedure. The procedure can be done through a small 1-inch opening in the scrotum, usually under spinal anesthesia. Patients go home the same day or spend one night in the hospital. Devices will break eventually. They're filled with intravenous saline, so they're very safe. When the device leaks, it is removed and replaced. Most patients will enjoy the use of the device for about 10 to 15 years. When it breaks, we just take the device out and put another one in. Now, there are side effects, and these include malfunction and infection. The infection is a big issue because if a device gets infected, it needs to be removed completely. Then the penis will shrink, and it will be much more difficult to put another implant. So doctors can sometimes do a salvage procedure. It is important to seek a healthcare professional who is very comfortable and familiar with these devices. Very few urologists actually do implants. Fewer than 7% of the urologists actually are familiar with urological devices such as sphincters and implants. So I urge you to consult with your healthcare professional and get the right referral so that you can be taken care professionally. To avoid infection, there are many techniques, but really the best way to avoid an infection is to do the whole procedure without touching the skin, because the reservoir of bacteria is really the patient's skin. And we've developed a procedure of doing, we call it the no-touch technique. And with that technique, we've reduced the infection to 0.46% in a series of over 2,300 patients. Now, implants are covered by most insurance, including Medicare, Medicaid, and it's always useful to pre-certify. However, make sure your insurance covers that device. The best part of getting a penile implant is that you don't think about the erectile dysfunction anymore. You're free from thinking about it, whether you are sexually active or not. You no longer think about that. So again, what I'd like to finish my presentation is just to inform you that it's very important to communicate with your healthcare team to speak up. Very often, patients are a little bit shy to talk to their cancer doctor. You will not offend the doctor. The doctor knows that there are side effects to the prostate cancer treatment and expects you to seek help. It's better for the patient to ask for help or than to suffer at home with incontinence or impotence. These are important issues. These are quality of life issues. This is the zest of life. The treatment options are good. We can solve the incontinence. We can solve the erectile dysfunction. So really, there's no reason to live with these limitations. And I think that quality of life is primordial, and one should always keep that in mind. With that, I'd like to conclude and thank you very much for the privilege of discussing these issues with you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. E. It's a wonderful presentation, very, very informative, and also just in terms of just so important in terms of everyone's quality of life and that zest for life. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And, we do now have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring both Dr. Slovin and Dr. Eid back so that we can take questions. And if Stephanie, could you explain to the audience how to queue up for questions? And we'll try to take as many of your questions as possible.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Emil S. Your line is open.
Hi, this is for Dr. Eid. Before I have sexual relations with a partner, I have urine leakage even after I think I fully emptied my bladder. This can be very embarrassing. You said something about taking Sudafed. I also take Vesicare every night around 7 p.m. because I have the leakage. I have the constant urine when I'm in a horizontal position. I found that it's also related to temperature in my apartment or outside. If it's warmer weather, I don't get up as often, even with the Vesicare. And in the colder weather, I get up more frequently. I also was taking Viagra up until about 3 weeks ago for 3.5 years. I stopped taking it because I didn't think it was doing much for me. I can still get an erection, not as hard as before, but I can still get an erection and have an orgasm. Could you...
Your question, Emil? Oh, your
thank
question?
You. The question is, what prescription strength should I get with the Sudafed, and should I stop, go back to going on the Viagra?
Thank you for your questions, actually, and I'm going to ask Dr. E to address those in a general way, and then, of course, we will encourage you to go back to your treating healthcare team. But Dr. E, can you address those questions in general?
Yes, I think this illustrates the fact that the incontinence can be mixed. In other words, there is a component of overactivity of the bladder, which is managed by the Vesicare, and then there is the stress incontinence, which is the leakage standing or during sexual activity or during orgasm. So the question is a very good question, but these are challenging issues to deal with. The what Sudafed does is it tightens up the sphincters a little bit. I think most of us have experienced difficulty with urinating when taking these medications when having a cold, if there are no other issues such as hypertension, you must check that with your doctor to make sure that the medication is safe. But we generally give fairly high doses of Sudafed in the 120 milligram dose, and again, this must be discussed with your healthcare professional before you make any decisions on your own. This can help you once you take it about a couple of hours before anticipated sexual activity. We've also tried Cymbalta for some, and I think this has an antihistamine effect on the bladder and calms the bladder down in combination with Vesicare, Detrol, or Gelnique, which is another type of medication or a gel that will calm the bladder down. Mild incontinence can also be treated with slings, and so that's orgasmuria or urine leakage during orgasm. I think a sling is a good option for that, and again, you should discuss that with your doctor.
Thank
the
you.
Other question is with the Viagra. I think if the Viagra is not effective, there's no need to take it. If the erection is sufficient for intercourse, then I think it probably the best treatment option is to do nothing. If there's no improvement of the rigidity with either Viagra, Cialis, or Levitra, then penile injection therapy is, I think, an option.
Excellent. Thank you. We have a question from one of our online participants about Repaflo in terms of how it's used. How long it should be used, when they should be weaned off of it. I wonder if you could just in general, Dr. E, just comment about that.
Repaflo is a different class of medication. It's in the alpha blocker medication. In other words, it relaxes muscle that surrounds prostate and the urethra and makes it easier for men to urinate. Other medications in that class include Flomax, Uroxatrol, and these medications can be taken temporarily or ongoingly. A lot of patients after prostate cancer treatment, such as radiation, either external or by seed implant, will have swelling of the prostate, which is temporary, and may have what we call bladder outlet obstruction from the edema or swelling, and the medications can be taken temporarily for that purpose. Many patients who have benign prostate hypertrophy take these medications to alleviate the bladder outlet obstruction.
And we have another question from one of our online participants in terms of the risks associated with the suprapubic catheter.
Suprapubic catheter really is an old way of treating patients who either have a bladder that doesn't work anymore, such as a neurogenic bladder. We used to treat patients who were paraplegic or quad with this treatment option. It is much better to do intermittent straight catheterization than having a suprapubic tube, but for some patients that is an option that is not available, and a suprapubic tube is done as a last resort. It needs to be changed every 4 to 6 weeks, and it will increase the risk of infection and damage to the bladder and damage to the kidney. So patients need to be monitored by the healthcare professionals very closely.
And a question for Dr. Slovin, one of our participants, are there genes that put me at greater risk of getting prostate cancer?
It's an excellent question. There have been what we call mutations in a gene called the TMPRSS2, T-M-P-R-S-S mutation. It's been associated in certain very aggressive cases in prostate cancer. Unfortunately, despite our attempts at molecular profiling of patients' tumors at the get-go, we're still not ready to use these mutations as a means of prognostication or really treating the cancer. I would say that we know that there are family histories where not only the father, the grandfather, paternal uncles, and even maternal uncles have high risk of disease, but we're first learning about how these patients are being genetically evaluated to see if we can pick up any mutations. So right now the answer is no, we have nothing that's tangible, but certainly if there is a group of if there is a patient with a huge family history, multiple relatives on both sides, these are the patients who should be seeing a genetic counselor along with their relatives.
Thank you. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Diana B. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you very much. I was calling to find out, I was wondering, my dad was diagnosed with the cancer metastasized in his hip bones. He did do a surgical castration, and I was wondering if you suggested that he do radiation too, or is this castration possibly enough? And then I had another question about the catheter. He was given a catheter because his prostate was so huge that he wasn't able to urinate, and that catheter is causing him a lot of discomfort and pooling because he does a lot of in and out of vehicles while he's working. And I was wondering if you suggested anything else with that.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm going to ask Dr. Slovin and Dr. Eade.
And we'll have, I think, Dr. Eade right after. The issue of castration, surgical castration, where one removes both testes, is very appropriate. Many people don't like to do it, mainly because many men feel that that which is removed can't be put back, and they have a sense of discomfort, even though there are testicular prostheses that are put back. There's obviously no need for additional hormonal therapy in terms of injections, because you've already diminished the testosterone. Whether or not to do radiation, I'm not certain if you meant radiation to the prostate or to the hips, really is unclear at this time. We radiate if somebody is symptomatic, but other than that, I would not do any radiation. Usually if he's already undergone orchiectomy, I would imagine that any sites of metastatic disease would ultimately remit, and therefore doing anything additionally may not be necessary at this time. Had he been on hormonal therapy, you didn't mention how old your father was, but had he been on hormonal therapy, I might have recommended consideration of giving radiation therapy to the prostate with the plan of ultimately discontinuing the hormonal therapy. But again, it's very hard for me to know. Every case is individual. And your father may also find significant benefit of as a result of the orchiectomy to his voiding habits as well. And I will refer you to Dr. Ead at this time.
Dr. Ead?
Yes. Every case needs to be individualized, and it's difficult to answer questions specifically without examining and having all the information for the patient. But in general, you're absolutely right, Dr. Sloven. With hormone therapy, the prostate can shrink, and then the patient is able to void better. If a patient needs a catheter on a temporary basis, that is something that is doable for a month or so. But after a month, it's best either to go to intermittent catheterization or a suprapubic tube, which is, again, a temporary option. But, again, these are somewhat complicated issues, and the healthcare professional needs to be intimately involved with the patient to find out what is the best option for that patient.
Thank you. And thank you, Diane, for your questions. And I'll be happy to talk with you afterwards, Diane, to be sure that we can help you to ask the questions of your healthcare team. Well, I want to thank our speakers today. This has been an extraordinary program, very informative. We'd like to do more programs like this. It was just a lot of information on a lot of the side effects that many of you struggle with. Now, I also want to thank all of you who've asked questions, both online and on the telephone as well. I want to remind you all that this is a one-hour program and that when we plan a program like this, we recognize that you have so many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I don't want you to think that you're alone with any question or concern you may have, that you are now linked to Cancer Care, and we are simply a telephone call away at 1-800-813-HOPE. We have a staff of 40 master's level trained oncology social workers who are here to provide practical and financial assistance, counseling and support. We have support groups, both on the telephone and online. We have all these workshops and programs and all sorts of materials that can be of help to you. So as we conclude today, again, I want to remind all of you to take advantage of these services. They are free. They are, a phone call away, or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.